And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Dan Novak tells us why many artificial intelligence experts are urging a slowdown in such technological developments. Faith Perlow and Katie Weaver present this week's Everyday Grammar Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
hundreds of artificial intelligence experts and industry leaders are urging for a suspension in development of some AI technology. They say that the most powerful AI technology could present extreme risks to humanity and social order. The group released an open letter about the issue Wednesday. It referenced the recent release of a fourth version of the popular AI program, ChatGPT. We call on all AI labs to immediately pause for at least 6 months the training of AI systems more powerful than ChatGPT-4, the letter says. The product comes from Microsoft-backed developer OpenAI. It performs human-like discussions and creative abilities. Powerful AI systems should be developed only once we are confident that their effects will be positive and their risks will be manageable, the letter continues. The nonprofit group Future of Life Institute released the letter, signed by about 1,000 AI scientists, experts, and industry members, including Elon Musk. The Musk Foundation is the main financial backer of Future of Life. It also receives money from the London-based group Founders Pledge and Silicon Valley Community Foundation. Elon Musk is one of the co-founders of OpenAI. His electric car company, Tesla, uses AI in models with self-driving systems. Musk has been critical about efforts to regulate the self-driving system. But now, he is hoping an agency is created to make sure the development of AI serves the public. It is deeply hypocritical for Elon Musk to sign on, given how hard Tesla has fought against AI regulation in his self-driving cars, said James Grimmelman. He is a professor of digital and information law at Cornell University. Last month, Tesla had to recall from owners more than 362,000 of its U.S. vehicles. The company had to update software after U.S. regulators said the driver assistance system could cause crashes. At the time, Musk tweeted that the word recall for a software update is just flat wrong. However, Grimmelman did not disagree with the idea of a temporary break. A pause is a good idea, he said, but the letter is vague and doesn't take the regulatory problems seriously. The letter suggests shared safety measures could be developed during the proposed suspension. It also calls on developers to work with policymakers on governance. The letter noted danger linked especially to human competitive intelligence. The writers ask, should we develop non-human minds that might eventually outnumber, outsmart, and replace us? They also say that such decisions should not be made by unelected tech leaders. Yashua Bengio, often described as one of the godfathers of AI, was also a signer. Stuart Russell, a lead researcher in the field, put his name on the letter as well. Business leaders who signed include Stability AI CEO Emad Mostak. The concerns come as U.S. lawmakers begin to question ChatGPT's effect on national security and education. The European Union Police Force warned recently about the possible misuse of the system in phishing attempts, disinformation, and crime. I'm Dan Novak.
Popular television series The Last of Us is based on a video game series with the same name. In it, teenager Ellie and middle-aged man Joel are survivors of a disastrous pandemic. They travel together across an extremely dangerous, violent America to try to reach safety. A fungal infection has destroyed much of humanity. Ellie is immune and may be the only hope to develop a vaccine. During their travels, they often have to fight murderous zombies, security forces, and robbers. Along the way, Ellie finds a book of word jokes called puns. She reads some of the puns to Joel, who does not think they are so funny. Today, we will explore three kinds of puns from Ellie's book, their meanings, and how puns are created.
A pun is a kind of figurative language that uses a play of similarly sounding or similarly spelled words to create humor. Puns are used in writing, but we also hear them in everyday speech. Three kinds of puns are based on the difference between the sounds, spellings, and meanings of the words used. The first kind of pun is made with homophones, or words that sound the same or very similar, but have different meanings and spellings. In The Last of Us, Ellie shares a pun about a mermaid in math class. What did the mermaid wear to math class? An algae bra. Here, the play on words is the homophones algae bra and algebra. A bra is a kind of clothing. Algae are water plants, and algebra is a kind of math. It is funny to picture a mermaid going to math class to study algebra in her algae bra. Although Joel does not find that pun funny, Ellie thinks it is hilarious.
The next type of pun is a homographic pun. If words are homographic, they are spelled the same, but have different meanings. Ellie reads Joel another pun out of her book. This time, it is a homographic one. I stayed up all night wondering where the sun went, and then it dawned on me. Here, the pun is with the word dawn. The first meaning of dawn as a verb is to grow lighter, as the sun rises in the morning. If someone would stay up all night, they would see the dawn. The next meaning of dawn is to begin to think or understand something. If something dawns on you, you think about it in the moment. If someone is staying up all night and thinking about something, They might realize it in the morning, or it might dawn on them.
And lastly, we have compound or double puns. Compound or double puns have two plays on words within the same pun. The puns could be homophonic, homographic, or both. When Ellie first finds the book of puns, she starts off with this double pun. It doesn't matter how much you push the envelope, it'll still be stationary. This pun includes the idiom to push the envelope, which means to go beyond the usual or acceptable limits by doing something new, dangerous, or divisive. An envelope is also something that contains a letter for mailing. The second half of the pun includes the word stationery. Stationery is equipment used to write letters, including pens, paper, and yes, envelopes. There is another word that sounds the same, but has a different meaning. Stationary, ending in A-R-Y instead of an E-R-Y. Stationary, A-R-Y, is an adjective that means still or without movement.
When we first hear this pun, because speakers understand the idiom to push the envelope, they think the joke is going to go one way. Then they hear the second half of the pun, and they realize it is about literal envelopes. This is where the double meaning comes in. No matter how much you push the envelope, it will still be stationary. The first meaning is that the envelope will not physically move. By using the adjective stationary, that ends in A-R-Y. No matter how much you push the envelope, it will still be stationary. The second meaning uses the plural noun of stationary. That ends in E-R-Y, the letter writing materials. The meaning of this pun is that we cannot change envelopes because they will always be included in a box of stationery. In today's Everyday Grammar Report, we learned about three kinds of puns. One is homophonic. It uses words that sound alike but have different meanings. Another kind of pun is homographic, meaning words spelled the same but have different meanings. The final kind are the double puns or compound pun. Compound puns use two or more puns into one to create multiple meanings. Are you like Joel, who does not find much humor in the puns? Or are you like Ellie, who gets a good laugh at these jokes? Let us know, or tell us if you know other puns in English. Write to us in the comments or send us an email. learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Faith Perlow.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
You just heard Faith Perlow and Katie Weaver present this week's Everyday Grammar Report. This week, they talked about puns and the television show The Last of Us. Faith joins me now to talk more about this lesson. Hi, Faith. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
The Last of Us seems like a very interesting television show. I haven't watched it. What is it about?
It is about a pandemic and the survivors years later. Instead of a virus, there is a fungus that spreads and turns people into scary mushroom zombies. But it's much more than that. It's about a young girl, Ellie, who may be immune, and a man, Joel, who survives the first 20 years or so of the pandemic, and he's trying to find his brother.
So is Joel her dad?
No, he just agrees to take her across the country to a hospital. But at one time, he was a father. So there's this sort of father-daughter relationship that builds over time.
And where do the puns come in?
Ellie uses the Book of Puns to cope with their harsh reality, providing herself and us, the audience, with much-needed humor and comedic relief. But the book also has a special place in Ellie's heart. We later find out it was given to her by her best friend during a fun night at an abandoned shopping mall. The puns also help Ellie and Joel bond and understand each other.
It also seems like Ellie is just being a kid when she reads these puns, even though she has to defend herself and fight to survive. She's still just a kid.
That's right, Ashley. She has a lot of responsibility. So we see a different side of her through these puns.
Thanks for sharing about the show and its puns, Faith, and I'll talk with you again soon.
Thanks, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France, because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long, unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States, until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Bryan and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Bryan and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Bryan himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Bryan question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Bryan know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Bryan answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II, but neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, of change, and of struggle between the old and new values.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.